Welcome. Who's joined?
Hi, it's Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, Dave. How are you doing?
Great. Everything going super for you?
Wonderfully.
It sounds like it is, yeah. Excellent.
Thank you.
How are you finding the seminar so far? Is it what you expected?
Love it. It's actually much more than I expected, Dave. In all honesty, and you know I shoot from the hip, this is like seriously chock full of way more information than I could have imagined. And like personal like application. You know what I mean? The applicability of it is amazing and also surprising.
Well, good. I'm glad it's I'm glad you think it's helpful. I'm very interested in any kind of input and application and challenges that any of you have
mm-hmm.
for using the material and really applying it with your cases and thinking about it to see if it's useful to you and really thinking about your cases in a maybe somewhat of a different way. So
yep, that's exactly what I'll have questions around. I specifically have a question around that today, as a matter of fact, so that's good.
Let's go ahead and start while everybody's joining us. We can
oh, okay.
Started.
Are you sure?
Absolutely.
Okay. So in reading this section, which is map changes, this is actually, as you know, what we do as coaches. We help people identify their current story, and then in a very sort of wham, bam, thank you, man, very quick way, we get to, so what do you want your new story to be, you know? I mean, that's a very common set of coaching questions that I use that works really well because it helps people identify that they have a story that isn't serving them, right? And or that isn't theirs. I might say, whose story is that?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but then like there's like this deeper unfolding and unraveling of, you know, editing your life story and revising a storyline and changing only that which doesn't work and, you know, honoring what does. And I'm just wondering, like, how this could be longer than two or three questions. I'm sure you're going to get into that because that's what you certified coaches to do. But, like, what's the snapshot, Dave, of how we can use this in its fullest form?
I think I understand that, and it's a great question because it's way simpler to talk about than it is to do. To guide someone through the transformation and to be a catalyst for someone to change because, you know, it's kind of like you can get all the insight and all the best ways of doing stuff as an event, but then to make it a process to really
right.
bring about change, it's more of a challenge because the way the old story, which is not the old story for a client because it's the story, it's not just that client's story, it's the way things are, it's reality.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's exactly
yeah.
the way they experience it.
That's
and
right.
that means a couple of things. That means that they are seeing things the way they see things, but then calling it reality. And also, it's part of their identity. And anytime there is a belief or a fact or anything
mm-hmm.
Even broader, like a story that someone has, that's a part of their anatomy. That's in their brain. That's in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Their brain is in software and hardwired into the brain. So the changes will not come only as an aha, here's a better way, I'll do it,
mm-hmm.
because it just doesn't happen like that. But as we're catalysts to help someone go through the process of revising that, of looking at where they want to be, and every step along the way, that
mm-hmm.
our conversation with them is to validate progress, to resonate with the uncertainty and the trepidation because they are trying something new, and it's a temptation to go back to where they were because
mm-hmm.
that is, as we've talked a number of times, is the most fundamental identity, the most fundamental force of the human psyche is our identity. And the way we do things become part of our identity. So to change
mm-hmm.
means actually, among other things, not just the challenge of doing something different, trying out something that we don't know where it's headed or where it's going, even though it sounds good on paper, it's a narcissistic injury because
mm-hmm.
the way we fashion what we do is the very best we can do. And now, suddenly there's something better. Well,
mm-hmm.
there's a mourning of the old story and a kind of licking the wounds to say, well, yeah, it's exciting that there's something better, but I thought I was pretty damn good before, but here's something better. So it invites, and we're going to talk about this after we get through the steps and look at it again, to look at the process of change and transition from a different perspective, because somebody is always going back to the old story. And they will find new ways to go back to the old story. So that's part of the process. They're not trying to defeat us. They're simply being who they are because they want it, they need to touch base from time to time to reconnect with their identity just to see how far they've come. You know, kind of like have you ever gone back to some place like from childhood? For me, it was an auditorium. Whenever I did a performance in that auditorium, it was like, or a gymnasium, it was like the whole world was in that, and it, because it was. But in going back, you know, after college, it's like, wait a minute, there are only 150 seats in here. So, you know, to revisit some place we've been is useful because we can see how far we've come.
Yeah.
And that's another aspect of setting goals. Not just to go forward, but to be able to look back and see where we've been. So that's something that we do that I believe is really helpful to a client, to validate every step along the way in a positive way so that they can internalize that as part of the change, as part of who they are now, and this revision process. Does that make sense?
It sure does. And I love that. I love that, having that part about looking back so that you can see how far you've come. I think looking back is productive, but only if we take a quick glance, right, for reference.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like
exactly.
that.
And people want to be partway along in a new story, not to feel like they're starting at the beginning. So it's
Right.
to not to have someone look at this step in terms of the step in the process that's gone on before. And I'm going to talk a little, we're going to come to that in another part. There are some interesting studies about how to structure things and the difference it makes that people think they're into the process even though they're doing the same thing. But we're going to return to that. There's a particular study I want to mention that'll really bring it alive, but I want to kind of get a check-in from everybody. And so if that's the beginning, and I'm interested in your thoughts and your input and the rest of you, your thoughts and input too, because this is really the juncture of where our work is this present moment and the choice architecture of this moment and what goes into that and how that in itself is changing someone's behavior and their mind and their brain all at the same time. And I think this is the power of this system of thinking about things in this way, because there are ways that we can facilitate all three of those in a synchronistic way in simple language, in experience-near language to a client. And again, all this stuff we're talking about in the seminars, that's just for you to use as information. I wouldn't be caught dead talking to a client about this, you know. Even really, you know, savvy clients, they're not interested in the theories and all that, unless it's something really rare. But just the practical application, because they're going to be excited about the change and what they're seeing, and then they'll let us know how much they want to understand that. Some a lot, some none. It's okay to do it, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks very much, Jen. Let me check in with others. Who else is here and wants to check in? When, progress note, questions.
This is Terry Finney. I'm here.
Welcome.
Thanks. You know what? I had a couple of really good client sessions this week, and now I'm trying to like think of the details, and they totally escaped me. But two very huge shifts in two people I've been working with.
Well, good. That's great.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know the details, but I don't. Can't remember.
Well, may I speculate, since I'm free and I don't have to be bound by reality?
Sure.
I think what you may be describing is that you were in a particular state, a zone of really amalgamation with that client, and in a creative zone that you were responding very intuitively and not thinking about what you were doing, not as an observer. And when you're not in that state, it's not as accessible in terms of the facts of what you did, because it's part of that state. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the rat in the maze given amphetamine that I mentioned. And kind of like, you know, the name's on the tip of my tongue, I can't think of it, but then you relax and, you know, later it just comes to you. So I suspect you were in a zone, you were particularly immersed in engaging with that client in a real co-creative space of being very present, very centered, and the two of you interacted in a way that your brains were in synchrony. And there have been some actual studies that show when two people are really in a co-creative synchrony, their brains synchronize, harmonize, like musical instruments, if you were to graph it. And as soon as either one stops listening or there's an empathic rupture, boom, it stops immediately. So that kind of experience, you know, might be an explanation for, you know, any thoughts?
You know, I like that explanation, and I definitely remember it was two different clients and huge shifts for both. And I like that explanation, and it makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, I could probably go back and look through my notes, because afterwards I'm sure I wrote down what happened.
Your notes would access that state, and you would you know, recall it in some considerable detail.
Probably.
We're going to talk more about that as we look at Module 4 and states of mind, and I'm going to talk some specifics about that. Let's, you know, return to this at that point, because I think it'll make more sense as we look at some more aspects of that and entering and exiting different states, and especially as it involves work with clients.
Great, thanks.
So, yeah, thanks. Interesting. Anything else you'd want to talk about, or anything else going on for you?
You know what? No, but I love, well, I got new skis, so I'm pretty excited about that. But I really like the what you said about change being a narcissistic injury. I'd never thought of it like that, but of course it is.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which is really helpful in terms of understanding and being empathic about, you know, the resistance.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and if we think about from the perspective of the client and empathic resonance with the client may be resistant, but it's not directed at us. It happens with us when the client is able to create with us a bond, a working alliance, and show us more of what it's like to be him or her. Because when we're frustrated with a client, or we're feeling, you know, stuck about somebody's resistance, they are too. And what they're doing, one way to think about it is, they're not trying to oppose you or resist the process. They are doing exactly what they need to do. They are showing you exactly what it's like to be them. That's their job description, so that both of you together can understand it even more so, because it's not something that's talked about in objective terms, like, you know, like a goal and strategies. This is the part of coaching where we really earn our money, where someone activates an attachment pattern or a behavior pattern or a piece of interactional experience that shows us exactly what it's like to be them, so that we then can together find a way to talk about it and for them to become objective about it. That's why we have to have a good working alliance first, in order to be able to get away with saying something that has been part of someone's character structure and personality for a lifetime, but maybe hasn't worked. You know, I've given the example of, you're referred someone from the executive suite, and that person has alienated every person in the executive suite. It's only a question of time about whether that person is going to quit or whether that person is going to be voted out. And as a last-ditch effort, the person comes to you, and guess what? You're beginning to be annoyed in the same way the people in the executive suite were. That person is showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her so that you can teach it back in a way that can help revise the story or create a new one that's a different and better attachment pattern, because that's the only one that person knows, because that's reality for them. That's not their story, that's reality. So they're, you know, instead of seeing it as resistance, we see it as this brings alive in vivo with us within the relationship, which is why it's so charged and challenging, the opportunity to create a change with that person that they have never been able to do in their life yet. So it's a very powerful process in doing that. And that's why we check our egos at the door. We put our egos in a blind trust and don't take it personally, because, I mean, nothing is as good as a theory like this, but to really hear it in the way as, what is this person teaching me? How can we learn together what this person is doing with me so that it can be beneficial? Later, when we have a little bit more time, there's some very new work. In fact, a very new book has just come out about bringing neuroscience into conversations. And it's some simple stuff that people wise people have known for a long time, but there's some fascinating stuff that I'm going to summarize later on and add that I actually it's so hot off the presses, I just finished it last evening. So I'll get it together and add it to one of our later, probably our the relationship module, because I talk some about the relationship of the coach and client there. Most of the curriculum is about relationship, like coaching couples and that sort of thing. But this, what I add in the seminar part, is about the relationship of the coach and the client and the power of that. So I think I'm going to put it there. So I want to return to that. Does that so far, Terry, make sense in terms of your client?
It makes total sense.
Okay. Great. Thanks for bringing that up.
Sure.
Who else? Anybody else want to check in? I know Amy has not been able to be with us and was going to be with us today. Is Amy here? Not yet. Okay. Okay. Anyone else want to check in? Okay. Any other challenges or things, either from the material or from your clients, that you'd like to talk about briefly before we move into step five? Okay. Well, let's do it then, and I'll accept any questions or interruptions. Now, we've talked about the first four steps: recognize authorship, own your present story, assess the storylines and plot, and decide what to change. We're going to talk today about step five, mapping changes. Insight and understanding alone, as you know, are not enough to replace an old story. How many people do you know who can tell you all there is to know about something that they're struggling with, yet haven't changed? Underlying causes are always present for any problem, often complex, multi-determined causes. But a coaching approach is to use causes, feelings, history, as information to focus on now and plan for next. At times, simply doing what's currently effective dissolves barriers. And people need nudges sometimes when they are least likely to make good choices. For example, decisions that are difficult or decisions that are rare. Something like this has never come along before. Decisions for which they don't get feedback. When they have trouble translating what they're perceiving into understandable terms, or when they simply persist in re-entering the old story, which etches it further in the brain every time. So I think there are six crucial elements to map change. We're going to talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the six. This is an outline to master the storylines of a life story. One, regulate state of mind. Now, this is simply a précis for the entire seminar and all of Module 4 we're going to talk about regulating states of mind. This is simply an introduction, but this, I believe, is the most important thing that we can do as coaches. Usually, when I hear coaches engaging with a client, they start with strategy and talk about story. State always comes first. State of mind determines the meaning we attach to something. The meaning we attach determines our behavior. Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics in part by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. He did a series of trading experiments with economic graduate students. They were informed that the value of a security was $3. So think about how much difference there is between that situation and the stock market. The stock market has no absolute value. The price of a share is determined by what somebody's going to bid for it. So it's really an auction instead of the market. So these traders knew the actual worth of the security, a significant advantage over Wall Street. So what happened in price bidding? Remember, these were economic graduate students. They ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark, almost to $6. When other traders in the experiment stopped paying a premium, the laboratory market crashed. The second time around, the same group formed another smaller bubble. They got into the mid-$4 until it crashed again. Somebody recognized, well, the emperor doesn't have any clothes on. It wasn't until the third time that the investors actually wised up enough to stay with the security's actual value, even though they had known it from the very start. Now, Dr. Smith repeated the experiment with finance professors and other economic specialists. They formed the same kind of bubbles. Theirs wasn't as extreme. It was in the low fours and then the high threes, but still past what the value was, followed by the same crashes. Third time around, they stuck to the value. Bubbles are formed by optimism and collective tilt, herd mentality, getting on a feedback loop. Increasing prices stimulate optimism, causing more buying with price increases until the bubble, the state of mind, shifts. And again, it's the equivalent of the child who said, you know, the emperor doesn't really have any clothes on. Why are you guys acting like he does? This seemingly irrational force that overrides our logic and knowledge and causes us to believe that rising prices will continue to rise indefinitely, or at least as long as we're betting on them, called human behavior. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and then how we respond, of course. We each have a different sets of states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind and to know which state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing. They involve two very different parts of the brain, two different states of mind, and it's useful to not try to mix them and to do only one and then be in the state of mind to edit when you edit. Another, brainstorming versus completing a project, two different states of mind. When someone is in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain hijacks the intellectual logical brain and holds it hostage. So what do? Your brain is working against you. When you're in any state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings to restore a cool state, to get grounded and centered, to balance the left and right brain again. And poker players call it tilt. When you lose big or win big, you're emotional inclined to play your last hand or your leftover emotion. So with any kind of tilt, break the state of mind. Step away from the table, the poker, the conference, the dinner table. Take a walk. Wash your hands and face with cold water. Breathe deeply. Take a time out. Even sleep on it. let me think about that, get back to you, is a decision. And as you might guess, I have a more systematic way of going about regulating a state of mind, moving from an emotional cue or trigger through the usual response to a mantra to get centered, and then an ideal response. And we're going to talk about that when we get there. But this is key. And I think it's the key success strategy from everywhere in the executive suite to on the court or field. I just did a camp with pro. It's an interesting combination of pro football players and some very high-flying financial experts from Wall Street, and looked at the different ways they regulated state of mind, and what I've done with pro athletes is to help them get centered and reboot after every state, to reset after every play, because more than any place else in athletics and in the boardroom, you have to reset after every play, because you're likely to get on tilt from the last play. Something goes really bad or really good, and that's the time, the next play, you're most likely to make a mistake. So to reset after every play. We're going to talk some more about this. I'm going to give you some very practical things that I think will be very helpful with clients when we get to Session 6, Master States of Mind. So the key then is to respond when your state of mind is balanced. Right brain emotional plus left brain logical and intellectual equals a balanced decision. So you can get marooned in your right brain by emotional stuff. You can get marooned in your left brain with upsets or hurts and get into overthinking, into rumination, to obsessive loops and thought loops where you keep thinking about something and can't let it go. You can get marooned in your left brain too. And get marooned in your thought, just as the way you can get marooned in your emotion. The number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. It's like saying all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of really thousands of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. If you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel, change your thoughts. Now, the bad news is if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. According to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno, Z-E-N-O, effect says the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. It's like aligning a magnetic field. These chemical links become stable changes in the brain structure when they're repeated over time. The brain rewires. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. These brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. New neuronal networks and pathways are created when we focus on solutions, but the already existing circuitry is further etched when you focus on existing problems. That's how people can get stuck in therapy, to go back into the old story and write a better ending. 1,000 better endings later, it's still the process of recreating the old story, and it's further etched each time in your brain. Neuroscience validates the reality that it's not understanding the source of our thoughts that's most beneficial, the motivation, the cause, the dynamics, but a focus on awareness of choice. The law of attraction is based in neuroscience. If you lay a paper clip and a nail side by side, nothing happens. If you take a magnet and stroke the nail several times from head to point, it becomes a magnet and can pick up the paperclip because the molecules of the nail become aligned in the same direction and create a magnetic force, a polarity. Same with your energy field. When all of you is going in the same direction and focused, you have power. So the question is, what are you doing with your personal energy field? Each moment, how do you align and focus it? Now, the law of attraction and the film The Secret emphasizes ask, believe, and receive. My point of view is that's a little bit off. I think it's ask, believe, and create because it's not a passive thing. The law of attraction won't give you what you want. It will give you the energy to sustain the process to create what you want. It won't send a Brinks truck up your driveway or align the lotto balls for you. Trust me on that one and save some money. Or manifest a pizza. But you can align your internal molecules by focus and purpose to point to specific goals. It's a way to use your power to write the story you want. In fact, my favorite grandmother offered her critique of the film The Secret 4 decades before it was released. She said, "Wishes don't wash dishes." Now, the paradox is that we don't attract what we want, but we attract what we focus on. Everybody wants more money, so wanting is not the key to having it. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity aligns your energy field to pursue prosperity. Now, our unconscious doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus. It's kind of like the old style camera. The print or negative is the same thing. Your unconscious is that image. And remember, your unconscious is in the hippocampus, and it's the meaning that's attached to a stimulus that comes in. The power of focus is whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure it's on the right thing, not trying to reverse a negative. I want to get out of debt. That sounds good, but the focus is on debt. It's trying to reverse a negative, so the focus is still the negative. I want to lose weight. Focus is on overweight. Here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners really busy. I want to be really careful and not spill something on this new outfit. And here's just a very succinct overview of this by Dr. Joseph Murray. Your subconscious mind does not argue with you. It accepts what your conscious mind decrees. If you say, "I can't afford it," your subconscious mind works to make it true. Now, notice, practically speaking, which people worry about illness, which talk about pains or disorders. The people who are afraid of getting sick are the ones who get sick most of the time. What you worry about happens because you focus on it. So, put energy into what you want. Focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This creates resistance. When you focus on what you want, what you don't want just falls away, kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. Now, again, the energy we're talking about is not the energy of stamina, as in tired versus refreshed, but of energy field, this invisible, very real connection. Now, quantum physics offers us an additional paradigm that I think is really important. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective field. And you can tap into and resonate with this field, the quantum field of possibility. In fact, Einstein called this the unified field theory. Basically, he said the human mind and body is a bundle of energy and interacts with another person's bundle of energy, their energy field. And when we're with a group, the group's energy field as a whole. This is how we can read people, focus on choices, determine the flow of the future. So we project energy fields and like a magnet attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, that'll be what we create. If we focus on the positive and on solutions, that'll be what we create. Now, the addendum to this is that actions need to be in alignment with thinking. Negative or positive results don't just happen, but come about as a result of actions. Consistent negative thoughts send negative chemicals to the body and dis ease results. So when you're grounded and connected, and again, these are physics terms, grounded and connected to yourself, it opens doors and creates synchronicity. A popular term is in the zone, an internal alignment of your energy field. Your choices set this flow into motion, just as other choices can derail this process. You set your day in motion, for example, when you wake up happy and excited about what you're going to do that day. Days when nothing goes right can usually be traced to an instant where you've disconnected from yourself, such as a bad feeling or a disturbing thought or even stubbing your toe when you get out of bed. You create your state of mind and set yourself on a particular path. There have been a couple of instances with clients who have had such significant things that have happened to them in their life or in their work that every day was coming to be a bad day. They were dreading going to work. There were certain things that were happening there. And I ask each, and the principle here, what I'm about to illustrate, is that we're always asking ourselves questions. We're always wondering about what can go wrong, what's going to happen today. And we do this each morning when we wake up before we're even consciously aware of it. We think of something and ask ourselves a question. So what I recommended that they do was before they went to bed that they write down three empowering questions, questions that would put them in a positive state of mind, a peak performance. And as soon as they woke up, turned on their lamp, answer these questions. And they found that within a few days, it totally changed their outlook because once they started in a positive way, it built on itself. Now, and think about how someone's energy field tells you immediately whether they're warm and inviting, cold or stay away, charismatic, energetic. So the secret, rather than being about wishing for something and getting it, is about understanding and refocusing personal energy. Let me give you a kind of an extreme but a related example. Infertility. For someone who has an urgency to get pregnant, the desperation can sabotage intention and create a response in the body that can prevent pregnancy or some other kinds of disharmony internally or between the couple. When you release the urgency, focus on positive, on a positive focus, it can change the results. There was a good-sized study that was done on couples who had three consecutive spontaneous miscarriages. And when they had an intervention and did work in the way that I'm describing, over 90% were able to then conceive. Now, the law of attraction is neutral and impersonal. It works equally for positive or negative thoughts, good things or bad things. You keep coming back to what you run away from. You attract what you resist because you engage it with focused emotion. So the most important principle is to focus on what you do want rather than what you don't want. Now, most focus, as I mentioned, is outside awareness, the questions that we're always asking ourselves. The challenge is to target the specific outcomes that you want. Discover all the things you focus on that you don't want. And make a list of those. And that's not to continue the focus, but to make a to-don't list so that as soon as you begin to focus on this, you can be aware and have a to-do list that you can immediately move to and focus on. Let's do an articulate your unconscious exercise. What I'd like for you to do is to say to yourself internally, after every statement I make, your wish is my command. Consciously and in a focused way, say to yourself silently and internally, your wish is my command, and be aware of your experience. I'm tired. I'm late. I'm overweight. I'm eating healthily all day. I just worked out and feel invigorated. I am saving money for my future. Now, what were you aware of in terms of your experience in your body with each of these? Any differences?
Tremendous. Tremendous differences.
That's what's going on all the time, because our unconscious is always saying, your wish is my command. So be very aware of what you're consciously focusing on, because you create and you can shift or change your state of mind. Now, thinking this way isn't magical. It requires discipline. This is why most people don't have a spectacular result. Spectacular results require mind and brain consistency for 25 to 30 days without reverting back to the old pattern. You know, you're going to naturally be ambivalent and resist change. Just don't act on it. But the pen is in your hand to write your story. And since you're writing your script, be aware of these two questions. Are your thoughts worthy? And are they worthy of you? Two quotes. One from William James, the father of American psychology. Wisdom is learning what to overlook. And the other, my favorite grandmother, the secret critic. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And a final vignette on focus. One evening, an elder Cherokee told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, my son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. One is evil. It's anger, envy, jealousy, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, lies, false pride. The other is good. It's joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, compassion, and faith. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his granddad, which wolf wins? And the wise Cherokee said, the one you feed. Three, visualize changes. Here's the prototype of a classical study. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. A second group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. The third group practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, 0% improvement. The second group, actual practice, 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. The third group, practice by visualization only for about 5 minutes, 23% improvement. Now, subsequent studies have refined this, and there are better results in almost every study by the visualization, because in a study like this, for example, you don't have to shoot and then self-correct and then shoot again. You can visualize perfect shots over and over. On brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as with actual shooting. So, to create a vision, be very specific about developing it. There's a chapter in the book I'm going to send you, Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual, just in another couple of weeks. There's a whole chapter on visualization, the new science of the old art of visualization, and a part of that is on affirmations, which is the story to accompany that. The story is about revising mind software. The visualization is about rewiring the brain. And it's a compilation of what kind of things will work the best for affirmations and what kind of things will work the best for visualization. So every image draws you toward its conclusion. And an image is like a goal. If you create a negative image, like I can't dance or I'll look goofy if I really cut loose, then your brain will draw you to it. If you picture yourself as not able to dance, then the image says I can't dance, and you're going to live into that. You'll stay in that zone and that self-image and create the experience. You can create something else instead. So create an image of your goal and live into it. Let's do a specific example. About weight and body image, a focus and visualization exercise. Focus on the weight that feels good to you. picture what you'll look like at that ideal weight and look at those pictures daily. Write down your ideal body weight range. Focus on the body you want, your ideal weight range, your ideal body, your true body self, in other words. And remember, it has to be your body at ideal weight. You can't lose weight and have Alicia Keys' body, or lose weight and be as you were 25 years ago body. Don't focus on losing weight. Don't focus on fat thoughts like slow metabolism or hereditary body size or slow thyroid or the spirit of Great Aunt Sally that channeled bigger thighs. Look at and admire your body. Be grateful. Keep in mind the pictures you have. When you eat, be entirely present to the act of eating and to your body. I would ask each of the people, when I had had one of the first two or three major eating disorder treatment programs in the country as a psychiatrist in the 80s, I would ask each person, at what point did you have a shift in your state of mind? For example, people who are bulimic. And every person, 100% of people, as they really looked at it frame by frame, said, the instant before the food ever touched my mouth. It was the anticipation that was state-changing. The food was only a prop and a process, and an unnecessary one at that, which emphasized the power of someone's mind, the power of state of mind. And I also asked them to visualize the food once it entered their body and visualize it being assimilated into their body, because as soon as they anticipated eating, they zoned out and then would eat a bunch of stuff. And there was no accountability, no choice of each bite is a choice. And all this horrible stuff they didn't want to account for, so they purged. So once they began to think about, like, we don't think about it. You know, we think about, you know, you eat a bite of steak, you eat a bite of broccoli. You don't think about little molecules of broccoli in your body nurturing yourself. But if you think about what the body does then with that food, you become accountable for it. You become accountable for that whole cheesecake, and you're not likely to want to think about that and imagine your body then having to deal with it, which, of course, it does. So it builds in an accountability up front. So think about and feel as though your desire is manifest. Create your body as your life intentionally. And remember the ABCs: ask, believe, and create. Now, there's a portion of that chapter is also about the art of the visualization, about going through all the senses. I'm gonna defer that, so we'll have more time for discussion at the end. But it'll be in that chapter. And I think it's a really useful way to look at dealing with fear of success or fear of failure, to create a vision and then have somebody back into it, because you're creating a future memory, and you're etching, when you revisit that vision a couple of times a day, you're etching that experience in someone's brain, so that it's not like they have to be phobically avoiding the success because they already have created it, so it's only a matter of strategizing how to get there. One of the first books that I did as a psychoanalyst was Fear and the Fear of Success in Women. And I'm mentioning this because I have totally changed my mind and approach since writing the book. Was later named one of the 100 most influential professional books of the 20th century. And I'm telling you, there's a better way, and I've changed my mind. I think the way that we deal with things in coaching, with visualization and with affirmations for certain people at certain times, can be much more powerful than the analysis of success phobia, and much more effective in a much shorter period of time. Now, the science of the vision is that PET scans, positive emission tomography of the brain, confirmed that visualization brings about actual changes in the brain. And the brain assimilates a mental picture. The same stimulation occurs in the brain system with actually seeing something as visualizing it. The brain can't tell the difference whether it's something you're imagining or bringing in from the optic nerve. Replays of the visualization, like repeating the vision of successfully attaining a goal, programs neural networks and neuronal pathways to more strongly etch the experience. And one of the simpler facts that have been known for some time, mental visualization of complex movement can actually improve performance. So we know, for example, that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight or flight. So when you program your unconscious, you actually create a future memory to live into. The brain can't tell who conjured it. You are reality. And the more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now, here I think is the key. You don't make brain changes permanent unless you incorporate it into your story, unless you make it part of your identity, as we've talked about a number of times. Otherwise, it doesn't register, or it gets extruded as noise, or we go back to an identity and see the behavior just as, you know, something that we did for a time, but going back to a core identity. And this is why I think 95% of people who diet gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image, their software. For example, if you see yourself in a successful business, you create the specific imagery to live into that experience. You then incorporate it as part of your identity rather than it belonging to someone else. Now, here's a caveat. While your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. And your conscious mind then must incorporate the evolving story to include and assemble the imagery as part of that story. Otherwise, unconscious message, you're going to delete access or believability of the imagery. So there are three key elements here. One, repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your new vision must be renewed and repeated regularly, or they'll be eliminated until they become the default mode. Secondly, consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be ultimately metabolized as part of the self. In other words, to evolve identity, the model of who you are that you're operating on. Or you'll lose the vision or revert back to the old behavior, basically. And thirdly, be very specific about the experience of having achieved the goal. And there's more in that chapter about specifically how to go about constructing a vision. Now, a margin note. Write it down for review. Research on memory tells us a new idea or fact lasts an average of 40 seconds in short-term memory. Then it's gone. Unless it's emotionally significant or if you work to log it in. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. An example. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Now, before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions by one stroke. He had 299s, the rest were triple digit. To preserve his sanity, he learned to visualize golf. He selected his favorite country club. He would get in his car, have on his golf clothes, drive to the country club, get out, warm up, smell the grass, look at the sky, got into every shot, walked to the ball, observed the whole thing, spent 7 hours a day doing this. After he was released from his captivity, playing golf in his mind, 7 days a week for 7 years. His first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision of mind over matters. 4, insight changes the brain. At the moment of insight, an aha experience, a complex new set of neural connections is created. three different parts of the brain light up on fMRI scans during these moments, and we're vaulted into an altered state of mind that is more synthetic and integrative and more creative. An aha experience, moment of insight, activates these centers in the brain that release chemicals, dopamine and norepinephrine particularly. It's exciting and stimulating to have this aha. When someone is given information, a directive, an order, a fact, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Now, as important as this insight-induced change is, it's the sustained tension that hardwires it into the brain circuits. Five, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze, plan, think, and organize are all really important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it in motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes to produce results. Let me get a background noise mute, a star six, please. Thanks. Unless you're ready for a question or want to discuss. Now, this may be the taking action part. This may be why a group of some of the brightest people anywhere with all kind of degrees can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. And I was involved with a group like this, a group of very sophisticated people putting together a new company. Board was full, the founding group was full of all kinds of stuff, but couldn't, you know, had a struggle making it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who barely finished the second semester of the first year of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. So take action. Make it organic as you move ahead. Do it and then self-correct. Six, identity transformation, the last step. A new experience or idea must be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized. The mindset of identity then incorporates the new experience and integrates it as part of an evolving self, as an evolving component of one's identity. Otherwise, it's not integrated and prone to be dismissed as a not me or attributed to luck or to circumstance. The most important thing about a goal is having one. Wisdom is to know the right path, and integrity is to take it. So let's just do a brief summary here before we have discussion. The science of change in coaching. Coaches focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on co-creating options rather than advice or dictates. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on the new experiences to change this wiring. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story. First is by recognizing the story, claiming ownership, and then to understand, assess, and change. And for someone, it may be to help them adjust their expectations, because they may think that having an answer is going to be the same thing as living an answer, rather than a first step. Peter Drucker said the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So here are some important elements, I think, some bullets about mapping change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't dissolve it or solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate your state of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning. Left brain plus right brain, intellectual plus emotional. Facilitate insight whenever possible rather than giving advice. And people can usually discern between inquiries that prompt insight and attempts at persuasion. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. This is the evolving new story, the new model someone is operating on. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new ideas or the new behavior. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and the brain. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This level of conceptualization gives a new level of mastery. This helps create the outline to incorporate the new experiences as a storyline and especially as part of an evolving identity. Well, what kind of thoughts and questions do you have? Does this make sense in terms of just an overview of mapping changes? Let me ask more specifically. Is this different than how you've conceptualized it thus far, or is this just a way to articulate it?
It's not different. This is Terry Finney. It's not different than my thinking. It's more articulated, which is helpful.
Okay. Well, that was the last point I made. To help a client articulate something and to create a new map or a new metaphor is a new level of mastery, because that offers an access and a way of bringing together subjective and objective at the same time, and a new metaphor changes the brain. It creates a map in the brain. So I think it's a particular way of mastery of helping someone do that. And it's not the same as intellectualization, which is to, you know, look at a diagnosis or an intellectual explanation in lieu of doing something about it. But it's just incorporating changes and talking about them at a different level.
Yeah, it's great. It's really helpful. It's great.
Well, good. Good. Other thoughts and questions? Anything that you want to go back and talk more about or look at examples of from your own practices?
Yeah, I have a question for you, Dave. This is Jen.
Okay.
I heard you say, and I do believe that it's the how, like when you were talking about the law of attraction and this modified approach that you have that I agree with. And then is the how important? Is the how they're going to get there important? Because in my studies, I've learned that sometimes if we can really put out there what we want and be really clear and visualize, like you're saying, then the how can be beyond our wildest expectations. But with our clients, we specifically work on the how quite a bit. Okay, so how are you going to do that? Or what are some next steps, right? And so, like, what is your take on the importance and how it weighs out between the what you want and then the how it's going to manifest?
You know, that's a really good question, and it's kind of complex. It's a great question, and I'm not sure I have as clear an answer, because I strongly believe that we are very spiritual and energetic beings beyond nomenclature, beyond concept or words to describe that, and sometimes we can only understand something in retrospect and make it make sense because that's how we process in our brain. We make decisions at the midbrain, and then we kick it up to the forebrain to make it logical and sensible and to light on something that makes sense, that's tangible. So the how is not always an understood thing. So we can get there and maybe look back and reconstruct the how and put it together in a way that makes sense. That's the same kind of secondary process that we make a decision at the midbrain level and then several seconds later become conscious of it and attach it to something that makes sense that we can then talk about. Kind of like we buy emotionally and justify logically. And neuroscience, neuroeconomists tell us now that we make purchase decisions often 10 seconds before we are consciously aware of them. And neuroscientists more and more are saying that the primary function of the forebrain is to find ways to make logic and sense of decisions that are already made at the midbrain. Now, in terms of coaching, I think that this is where we really need to probe about what kind of plans someone has and how they are going to bring about something, what they commit to do. Now, on the one hand, someone is only able to imagine within their own system. So they're going to have to expand and get beyond that system sometimes to really imagine in a way that can exceed their previous achievements. And they may not know how, because in that system they've been bound to certain ways that have been repetitive and possibly not productive, or at least have a glass ceiling. So both the vision and the how are going to have to expand. Now, that can be limiting to reduce it, but for certain clients, it's essential to plan. Otherwise, they're going to lapse into a passive mode and start visualizing a pizza and imagining it to manifest, and that ain't going to work. That we need to look at to help someone, for example, create a vision, and to look at the vision they're creating, if it's truly their full capacity, or are they just, you know, pulling up the finish line a little short and saying they finished the race and they won, and are they limiting themselves, and to look at helping them tweak that if it's not to their fullest capacity. Look at a stretch goal. What are your goals? What's a stretch goal? Something beyond that you've never imagined. And then look at the plan to back into that, because that's what they're going to have to be consciously focused on and generate a plan to back into that goal that they've been imagined. Now, things are going to happen that they could have never imagined. They're not going to be able to explain the how, but they're going to have a plan and a strategy to be able to have a map. We're creating a new map, but what a map does is to create a specific goal, so that you can see not only where you are and where you're going, but you can measure progress along the way, and you can tell what's detour and what's distraction. So I think the how, to not be bound by the how, but not to give up or not to expect the how is just going to magically happen. So I think it's a blend of that, of the practical.
A hybrid.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
good. To be beyond where you have been before, but then to get there, you have to do some strategic planning, and you have to take steps, and they're concrete, tangible steps, one at a time.
Yeah.
Make sense? How do you think about it? You have some thoughts to raise a great question like that.
Yeah, I do have. I straddle both worlds, right? Because I am a very practical minded person that likes to know how things are going to go down. But then I also have this very intact spiritual belief that isn't always with me, but when I remind myself, it feels right. You know, it's just like, yeah, the how is could be beyond what I could even imagine. So I just need to know the what and then put energy towards it, right? So I think for me, as I'm talking out, the how it's going to be done is not specific steps, but like put energy, put some sort of thought, energy, intention, movement behind it. And then the specifics of the how it's going to happen will work itself out. But to be like real hell bent on exactly the, you know, the plan of attack and all the things and the details that are required to know how it's going to happen, I think is probably not going to be the best way. So I like
this.
Let
me give you an example of two people you know, and we've made our collaborations open. Neither have been a client, so it's not anything confidential. When Will Craig founded CTA, he said he never had or set a goal in mind. And he created one of the great coaching institutes in the world in doing that. And he and I talked regularly and at length about a number of things, including how he went about things, not having goals and not planning. And he was able to achieve some remarkable success. And Chris Osborne is just the opposite. He has had a series of coaches, often a couple of coaches at the same time, highly plans everything, and has taken CTA to a whole other level. So he's had his own significant measure of success. So sometimes it's you know, from that I would gather that at times it depends on the developmental sequence that you're in. When you're in a total startup, you know, sometimes the how is going to have, you're going to have to see. And and sometimes as things are evolving in a later stage, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when I write a book, I don't write because I have something to say. I write to see what I have to say, and how I choose what I write about is what I most want to learn. So it's a learning process, and it's not, you know, then I'll develop a plan, maybe a book outline, but that's into it. That's not where I start out because, you know, I'm really engaging the process to see what I want to learn and what I have to say. Then I can put it into an outline. That's not exactly what I teach other people to do, but, I think that's, you know, that's one example of an amalgamation like you're talking about in you know, both worlds. Because I do think it takes both.
Yeah. And also it depends on the person that we're talking about, right? Because I remember when we worked together as coach-client, when you were coaching me, Dave, one of the things that you asked me to do was to create a business plan. And, like, the minute I heard that, I was, like, completely, like, recoiled. I don't know if you remember, but, like, I was, like, I remember literally going to Starbucks with my laptop and the template you gave me to sit down to make this very detailed, very important document for my future business plan. You know what I mean? The plan of my business growth. And I literally laughed.
Your shutter came through the fiber optic. Fully.
Yeah. It just came like two sips of coffee, and I'm like, I'm done. I'm out. I can't do it. And that was a really important exercise because I got to learn, like, okay, so if this isn't it, what is it for me? You know what I mean? So taking into account, like, who you're working with. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of also like saying, you know, some parents, you know, teach you how to be a good parent because they show you all the things not to do.
Yeah. Same. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, great example. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's totally a co-creative effort and to really resonate with a client and see what, you know, what works and what doesn't and to do that. And to have the openness to say, you know, this just sucks, or, you know, on a class part, you know, I've been thinking about this. I think that was a mistake. I mean, I think we need to remain open to outcome and be able to quickly see what works and what doesn't both ways and to talk about it.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it also probably depends on the type of goal. Like, a bit like starting a business would be a whole different set of goals than working on relationship changes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, two different kinds of maps.
Right.
Yeah, great point. Anything else? Just, Nicole, you have maybe a minute or so left. Any other things you'd like to point out or discuss or leave us to think about for next time? Any unfinished questions? Yes, go ahead.
This is Tisha. How are you?
Hey, welcome. How are you?
Good.
Great.
This is a really great lecture. I really thoroughly enjoyed it for a lot of reasons, but I know we don't have a lot of time, but I do have just one question. You spoke a bit earlier in your lecture about, and I'm not using the right term, but basically like a collective energetic experience. So you know, we can feel others' energy and kind of have a sense of how to receive them or how they may receive us. And so it's kind of this relationship, sort of energetic relationship, and that also can sort of create this broader this path, or this can affect the environment in which you and this other person might be in.
Yes.
And so I'm curious as to what you think the relationship or the balance between the individual being creating their own path or their own sort of space versus the kind of co-creation that is involved in really creating the path or helping to sort of create the reality. And I don't know if I'm sort of making sense, but when I'm reading your material, there's such an emphasis on the individual and the individual creating their their reality.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. And let me begin an answer in a couple of different ways. One is, I think that the point that we're talking about here is for each of you as coaches to know yourselves quite well, to know your own story. And remember, I've emphasized doing the exercises, coming to know your own story, because that's going to put you in the very best possible position to help your client work with his or with hers. Now, when you are very aware of your own experience, you are able to more accurately read what is coming from the client and to discern and specify your intuition. And you can catalog many different kinds of intuition, dozens of different intuitive blinks that you get that can become very, very specific when you're accurately reading someone else and really know yourself quite well. Now, two things I want to mention, because I know we're a little bit over. One is Google intuitive empath, intuitive empath, empath. Because I'll bet each of you will recognize yourselves quickly. And look at, just pick one of the top two or three articles and look at what you have to do to protect yourself when you're an intuitive empath. Because of the toxicity and the negativity from other people, it's a specific example of this, because you're going to be aware of very positive things, you're going to be very aware of negative things. Look at what you have to do to protect yourselves from negative influences, and how you have to really be aware of regulating that and protecting yourself. And let me give you a demonstration example of, and let me just tell you about this. Some of you may have seen this. I have done presentations, for example, where there's a group of people, and I'll ask for a volunteer to come to the front and ask that person to put her left arm out and resist me pushing it down with her greatest strength. And I can push it down, but it takes a good deal of effort with one arm. I'll ask then the group to send her very positive energy, wonderful thoughts, energetic thoughts, good thoughts about strength, about power, about positive energy, and try to push her arm down, and I can't get it down. I couldn't get it down with both of my arms. Now, I'll ask the group to send her negative energy, negative thoughts, negative energy, and then as she tries to resist me, I could push her arm down with one finger. That's the kind of interplay of energy fields that we have, and when it's focused in a specific direction, it becomes much exaggerated and more specific. And that's one of the reasons that away games are, and home games for teams are real different, because of the focused energy and how you have to work at that as an athlete to reframe all that, and a number of things like that. But that's just an example of really being aware of what comes from you so that you can be aware of what comes from the client. It's in another way, let's take a more tangible thing, and I'll wrap this up in 15 seconds. You're aware of you, and you're aware of yourself and how you come across. The client perceives you in a particular way. Now, you may want to consider this for a second to see of accuracy, but you can tell if it's transference. You can tell if it's something that they're perceiving that comes from their system that they're transferring to you that comes from their story and that is their perception. So you don't have to adjust what you do, but you can see it and read it as it is, that they're seeing you as like, you know, a little sister that they had a lot of competitiveness with, and they're, you know, feeling competitive and angry right now because of the particular way you said something that reminded him of that. So that's another place to be aware of yourself so that you can tell how you're perceived and know the difference between the two. Does that begin to answer your question, Trish?
It does. It does answer it from a client coach perspective. I'll follow up with you via email because there's a sort of another component to it. And then,
okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah, send it, and then let's pick up here because I think this will be interested in others' responses too, because we have some very seasoned coaches and great minds here. I'd like to develop this more as a group discussion as well. So thanks very much. I appreciate it, and I appreciate all your input. I welcome and value that. We'll pick up right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. Bye now.
You too.
See you guys.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks, Dave.